This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I am so happy to welcome back today a guest. He was here just a few weeks ago. I didn't have enough time to talk to him. I could talk to him all day. And I am so happy to welcome James J. Brosnahan back to Joy on Paper. The name of his book is Justice at Trial, Courtroom Battles and Groundbreaking Cases. Welcome back to Joy on Paper.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, you are so interesting, and there's so much I want to talk to you about. So, could I use your first name? Would that be?
Yeah, no, that's what I use. Jim.
Jim. Okay, yep. Jim, I want to be on a first-name basis with the lawyer.
Yeah, of course.
Well, and I would say you are a lawyer's lawyer. If anyone lawyer is in trouble, I think they'd want to come to you. And I have this love-hate relationship with lawyers. When I was young and I was in Hollywood, I got involved in a lawsuit with a major studio, and my lawyer was the nicest kid you ever saw. He was 6 months out of getting his bar exam, and he was all I could afford. And he appeared. I was suing a major, you know, film company.
Yeah.
We went to the meeting. We went to the meeting, and on one side of the table, there are eight lawyers.
Oh, good. That's always good.
Oh, that was great. And then on the other side of the table, I was sitting with this lovely, lovely young man who was wearing his best suit. I think he had got it at Sears and Roebuck. And on the other side, those guys were all wearing Italian suits and, you know, beautiful loafers from Italy. We didn't have a chance.
No, although I did have a case against 15 oil companies, and it was just me against the 15, and I kind of liked the optics of it. I mean, it was kind of, you know, a lonely battle, but I understand what you're saying. It's the law, it can be intimidating, that's for sure.
Well, and that, you know, now he's doing well. But on that day, I just looked at him and I realized he wanted to be on the other side of the table, and he wanted Italian loafers, and he would do anything. So we lost that case, which is why I am on the west coast of Florida instead of the west coast of
Yes, indeed.
But anyway, it was a learning experience. So that's my hate side of lawyers. Then I'm madly in love with a character I am writing, a story about a lawyer. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you back. Because I think my lawyer is you. Now, this case is from England, and it was in 1870s. But the thing is, he is very much, I think you would have the same personality. Now, he was a sergeant at law. I don't know if you know what that is.
I'm familiar with the term. I think it's not quite silk. And in England, silk is the best, people believe at least. And a sergeant is, I think, a little bit less than that.
Well, no. They don't have sergeants anymore. They at the time, and as a matter of fact, 1875 was the end of the sergeants, and he was the best. I mean, he was the best, the highest paid lawyer in England.
Oh.
And the wonderful thing about him is he didn't really care about money. He just loved the law, and he loved getting in front of a jury, and he loved winning. He loved winning. And so I think that very much I see his personality in you.
Well, it's true. I did. I had found my thing, and I loved it, as you say. So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
It's not the money. It's the fun of the challenge, the mental challenge, and going up against people and trying to get justice, which is the name of your book.
Yeah. No. That's the whole idea. And, you know, in other things like sports, people want to go against the best. And I always wanted to do that, even when I was a young lawyer, and I tried some cases against a man named John Flynn, who was the best lawyer at the time, and I just wanted to do that.
Well, you know, your cases are all so interesting, and as I mentioned the last time you were on, each of the cases is something really special. I know that it was wonderful, Dean Chermansky, University of California, Berkeley, gave you a wonderful foreword, and he says every lawyer should read this, but I think everybody should read this, because
I'm hoping, yes, you hit a very important point. I'm hoping the general reader would enjoy going into these courts and seeing what the judges are like, what the opponents are like, what the clients are like, what the young lawyers are like, because I had, as the years went by, I had teams of lawyers, and very often the young lawyer was a really prominent part of the story. So if you want to know what goes on in very different kinds of courts from the bottom to the top, this is I think a good book for that.
It is, and it is also, just from the historical point of view, you learned so much about American history from the period when you started, you know, trying cases to today, because you covered so many different types of cases. Now, one of them that I want to talk about, and I thought this is a good one to start with, it's when you were 34 years old. I think, you know, that's a great age, because you're old enough to know that you don't know everything. But
that was true.
You're young enough.
That was true.
You're young enough to hope that maybe you're the exception.
Yeah.
So
that's right. That is correct.
So I want to talk about the case of the Chronicle in San Francisco, because I remember when I lived in San Francisco, I worked for Booz Allen and Hamilton, and I remember, I mean, we had to read the Chronicle. That was, for me, that was the newspaper of choice. And I think your case that you explain that case, because I think that's the way that you went into it at 34 years old. You're taking on a major case for a major CEO. Tell us about him.
Well, it was Charles Kiriad was the publisher of the San Francisco Chronicle. It had been founded, if I recall, in 1863 by relatives of him. It was a family-owned paper, and it had wonderful columnists that were kind of disrespectful of the whole world in one way or another, and you had to read it in the morning. I mean, if you were going to go out and pour yourself a cup of coffee and talk to other people in the office, you had to know what Herb Cain and some of the other people had written that day. It was just that kind of electric publication. It also had about 350,000 readers, and but the case was about newspapers starting to go out of business. That's what that case is all about. And the Chronicle was doing okay, but their opponent, the Examiner, was becoming a failed company. And We went in San Francisco from four newspapers with four editorial points of view down to two, and one of them was about to go out of business. And Congress passed a statute that allowed the two papers to cooperate in certain economic areas. And the question was, did that violate the antitrust laws, or could they have a joint operating agreement? It sounds very technical, but it really meant the survival of two newspapers. And I was the lawyer in charge of arguing that matter for the first time in the country to test that statute. And I was 34, and I had to go over and meet Charlie Tyriot, who was royalty in the newspaper business at the time. And I was quite nervous about it, but he couldn't have been nicer. And so I tell the story I'm not a society person, but Charlie, I don't think he cared about it, but he was a member of the Pacific Union Club, and so he invited me up there on top of Knob Hill in San Francisco, and we were having lunch, and I was carrying some papers, and the maitre d' came over. He looked like a British earl. He had long tails and everything, and it was quite formal. And he said, sir, I'll take those papers from you, and you can get them back on the way out. In other words, you were not allowed to have business papers at the table. It was an old, wonderful club, but, I was a little out of my depth. In any event, to find out what happened, you have to read the book. And it discusses from a historical perspective where we are right now. And it occurred to me the other day, we have censorship going on right now. It's getting very serious. For example, this week, Texas has requested that book publishers rank their books in terms of certain criteria that Texas has imposed. And We don't know what's going to happen. That, but powerful newspapers years and years ago would come out so strongly on this issue, and they would be a major voice on fighting any kind of that kind of activity. So the history of newspapers is to some extent described in the, and the loss that we've experienced because of the loss of so many papers. Two papers a week go out of business. And that story is in the chapter.
Yes, well, that's true. We had right here in our Tampa Bay area, we had just, I would say, 8-9 years ago, we had a vibrant press, and now it's down, to nothing. I think we've got one sort of hanging on, and the paper is thinner and thinner, and they have less and less content. And it's sad because, as I said, when I was there, and the first thing we did, you're right, the first thing we did in the morning was read the Chronicle. And I always thought the Chronicle was better than the Examiner. It was more somehow it seemed more intellectual than the Examiner.
It was. It told all kinds of fascinating stories about the people actually around. And where do all those reporters go to get laid off? These are people who are very good writers. You have a writer's program here. Now, these are wonderful writers. They not only do their columns or the news, but they write books and they follow things and they like to go in depth. Where do they go? Some are able to do some television, whatever. But that whole body of intellectual people has been, in my lifetime, has been decimated. And of course, they continue and they try to find other jobs. But newspapers were a great source of intellectual ferment, calls for reform, exposure of government corruption, all those things, and it's different now.
Oh, it's changed, and it's right across the board, because even, you know, in publishing, we're talking about censorship before the book is even published, because more and more publishers have these requirements of what you can say, what you can't say. I've been doing this program for 9 years, and even in the 9 years, the change of, I have authors who say, well, I can't use that word, I can't say that word, I can't write that, I have to change this. Because somehow people got in their heads, everybody's so sensitive that we can't have this wide open discussion on both sides, either side.
You know, I anticipated a lot of that when I wrote my book, but I did have an expression that we used to use in Boston, where I grew up, and it was called a paddy wagon. Well, Paddy was a slur on Irish Americans, which I am. But the truth is, I took my wife on our first date. I took her to an Irish bar in Boston. And outside, they had two paddy wagons on Saturday night. It was kind of it was a rough, I don't know if I was trying to impress Carol, my wife, or not, but that's where we went. And so I happily had the word paddy in my book. No. And said with the publishing company, Roman Littlefield, and he said, we can't use it, you know. And I don't know, we used it back in the old days. But I know exactly what you mean. You know where that's also true? When you're a trial lawyer in 2023, if I was still trying cases, I would have to be very careful about language that might have been invented not very long ago, a way of talking. And I always tried to not irritate people by just so they just get the substance of the argument. So I know exactly what you mean, but that's not completely new. Things change, and it's kind of exciting in a way.
But, you know, the paddy wagon, I mean, that's such a, it seems such an innocent thing. I don't know that any Irish people get all upset about it.
They would have probably, 100 years ago, it was a term of derision in the Irish neighborhoods in Boston, certainly. But anyway.
I don't know. I will tell you, I have discovered over the time, too, that it makes the writing of words more bland.
Yes, although, as you know, the writers are encouraged to use active verbs, that part is okay. Somewhere deep, there's an important thing happening, which is movement towards equality, not arrival at equality, but movement towards equality. I think to some extent, the new terms, which I follow, terms. Yeah, I've done that my whole career, trying to, if referring to people with the terms that they want, as far as I can tell, when you stand up to a jury and you're describing some witness or saying something about a witness, you certainly don't want to use a term that somehow is out of date and is just not right. And that gets more serious the older you get as a trial lawyer. The older you are, how easy it is for a juror to say, oh, for goodness sake, he doesn't even know what the right terms are now. So
when we come to talking about juries, now, do you remember the first jury that you selected and how you felt that day?
Yeah, it's a bit of an unbelievable story, but I walked into the U.S. Attorney's office. My wife and I had moved to Phoenix, and we lived there for 3 years. And I got a job as a federal prosecutor. I arrived on a Monday, and they swore me in. And here I am. I went to law school to try cases. That's what I wanted to do. And I hadn't tried any cases. And so now I'm in the prosecutor's office, and on Tuesday, the boss came in, and he said, there's a trial on Monday. Will you try it? And I said, yes, of course I will. And I'm thinking, how am I going to do that? I've never had a trial. And he gave me the file. And so I opened the file, and it was a first-degree murder case with a request for the death penalty. And that was my first trial. And I tell that story, not only the seriousness of the stabbing that had occurred on a reservation in Arizona, and the death of a young man who was in his late teens, and the families of both sides, the family of the defendants and the family of the dead boy, and the electricity in the room was overpowering. But I got through it, and I tell the story of what happened in the book. Of course, as I sat there, I realized my 3 years of law school did not prepare me in any way for what I was going through. But I had some instincts about what to do. I had some assistance. An experienced person was my tutor, and he had taken me. We went out every night during that week to get ready, and he was giving me the basics, absolute basics of trial work, so I could try this case, and that was my first trial. Well, of course,
Were you allowed to ask the jurors, the potential jurors, if they believed in the death penalty?
Yes. Yeah, I knew enough to do that, and tell the story about a juror that lied to me. You have to read the book. I couldn't believe a juror under oath would lie to me, but he did. And you have to prepare the jury, and every judge is a little bit different as to what they will allow and what they won't allow. It's called conditioning, but they are going to consider the death penalty. A lot of people have feelings both ways about it. And so that was part of my questioning. It's probably pretty cumbersome questioning, but I did what I could to figure out, are they going to follow the instructions? But that week of preparation, I had to decide whether I was going to ask for the death penalty. And I wasn't. In law school, I was opposed to the death penalty. And these were juvenile defendants.
That's a difficult thing to do. Now, have you ever had, what's the funniest thing a juror ever gave as an excuse for not wanting to be on the jury?
Oh, Mr. Jones, do you have any problem with this case as we've described it so far, says the judge? Yes, I do. I'm a communist. I believe in the violent overthrow of the government. And, no, oh, okay, well, you know, you look around, where's the marshal when we need the marshal the most, you know? And I still think that he would just want to get out of jury service. I mean, I don't know. But, and he succeeded, I'll tell you. He was out of there in about 3 seconds. And you get some very funny, you do get a lot of comical response. I love jury selection. I always did. You just don't know. Some of the saddest stories you'll ever hear, a person sitting there will say, well, I'm the only support from my mother, and she's terminally ill. We don't know how much time she has left. And if it's okay, I'd rather serve on some other jury that's not quite as long. You know, this very polite, nice person. And so you sit there, and during recessions, people are unemployed. What they really want to do is go look for a job. You get all of that. You have a window into
human nature. It is really a look at human nature, because I was only called to be a juror once, and that was only a few years ago. A long time. I was always hoping to be on a jury. I wanted to be on a really great, murder trial jury, but it was a nice case. I thought I wanted to be on the jury. I wanted that experience. But I didn't know that people, I mean, they reveal so much about themselves while they're being questioned. Exactly, the stories about their mothers, the stories about this, the story that I had. There was one woman who got into this long story about how she absolutely could not make a decision one way or the other, because all of her life she's been it's been impossible. She said since I was 4 years old, my mother would say, "Do you want to?" chocolate chip cookie, or do you want a sugar cookie? And I could never decide. And she would get so mad at me. And she said, finally, she'd give me both.
There's a lot of that.
I love it. I thought it was so much funny. And the one juror was excused because he said, I am the home husband, and I have to take care of the baby. And I can serve on the jury if I can bring the baby, because my wife leaves the breast milk, and I can feed the baby while we're listening.
you're hearing all the difficulties that people have, and it's a window, for people who like books to sit there. I don't think there are very many Dell trials, by the way. I think anyone who doesn't have a lot to do, or they could go down like they used to in the old days and find a trial in the courthouse, a criminal case, whatever, and it's a saga. It's a story. Yes, you did it. No, I didn't. Perhaps the issue is mental illness and the competency to stand trial. It all pours out in the courts every day.
Exactly. It's better than staying at home and watching a rerun of Matlock. Now,
I think so, yes.
Now, I have to take a commercial break, but I want you to hold on. And when we come back, I want to talk. I've got a lot more questions for you, Jim. So just hold on. We're going to play Book Buzz, a promotion for a kid's book, and then a few commercials, and then I'll be right back, okay?
Okay, sure.
Hey everyone, it's Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety-Tock-Clock children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. We're all a little grumpy sometimes, but someone who's especially grumpy stars in the beloved children's book series, Grumpy Monkey. Yes, Grumpy Monkey is back in a spooky new tale called Grumpy Monkey, Don't Be Scared. The book was written by Suzanne Lang and illustrated by Max Lang. Grumpy Monkey Don't Be Scared tells the story of Jimpanzee and his friends braving the dark jungle to collect treats on Halloween. Everything is different in the jungle when it's nighttime, and they all become a little frightened by strange noises and smells. The scariest thing of all for them, however, is returning home without collecting any treats. The sixth book in the Grumpy Monkey series, it's already the number one new release on Amazon for children's ape and monkey books, as well as already making it on the New York Times bestsellers list during the first week of its release. This book is such a delight, and I hope you aren't scared when reading it. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's Book Buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my guest, James J. Brosnahan, and the name of his book is Justice at Trial, Courtroom Battles, and Groundbreaking Cases. Hi, Jim.
Hi there.
Okay, well, I'm back, and we just had a nice little promotion for Toastmasters about learning how to speak in front of people, and you certainly have done that well over your career. So tell us about the day that you first appeared before the Supreme Court.
Well, I had a very tough case. It was a constitutional case. It had to do with privacy, and the law was changing, and it was changing in a way that didn't help me, but I tell the story about the argument and how I started, and I was a little nervous, I guess, right at the beginning, instead of starting with if it pleased the court. I observed that the lectern that I was looking at, it was a wonderful looking thing, and I said, looks like you could make coffee in here. And Justice White leaned down and he said, we make a lot of things in there. The scene in the Supreme Court is an amazing room. There's black curtains behind the nine justices. When they walk in slowly, and the clerk yells out, oyez, oyez, which means pay attention. Everybody stands until they sit down, and there you are looking at them, and I made the best arguments that I could, and at the very end, Justice Rehnquist turned after the argument. He turned and looked at me, and he waved. And he did that because we had both for... I was in Phoenix for 3 years before moving to San Francisco, but during that time, I knew him, and he and his partner had actually offered me a job, but they didn't do any trial work, so I didn't take the job. But we didn't know at that moment what lay ahead for both of us, and what did I was called to testify when Justice Rehnquist was put up for Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. And the hearing was in the United States Senate, and I was called back to testify because I had investigated, as a federal prosecutor, efforts by the Republican Party to challenge voters at a voting district, which was primarily people of color. And so I went down and I took an FBI agent with me, and sure enough, there was Bill Rehnquist. There were long lines of people, and some were turning away. They had to go to work, and they decided not to vote. But I gave my testimony, and it was prominently displayed in the Washington Post and the New York Times, and that all happened. Well, I thought Joe Biden was the chairman of the committee. It was the Judiciary Committee, and they grilled me for about 3 hours, and I thought I did pretty well, actually. And so then I thought, and Biden said to me, he said, you know, you may have heard your career. You're testifying against someone who might be the Chief Justice of the United States. And I said, well, I know. I hope not. But in any event, 3 years later, the political parties in California, where I then live, we had moved here, hired me to represent them because the legislature had these statutes that told various political parties how long their leaders could serve and whether they could endorse judges, for example, and it was all First Amendment. It was a very interesting case. But of course, when I walked into the Senate chamber to argue it, there was Chief Justice Rehnquist sitting in the middle seat. And I had been trying to decide, you know, how do I handle that? And finally decided, well, I'll just, if he has a question, I'll answer the question, like always. And when my case was called, he got up and went through the black curtains and left eight justices to decide the case. And he did it. He had done it three other times. I signed a brief arguing that Roe v. Wade should be retained about a year before, and he had disqualified himself. Every time my name was on a was there on a brief, he would disqualify himself. It's very unusual, and he was doing it to show displeasure that I had testified against him. So the story of what happened in that second case is in the book.
Exactly.
And so is the argument. And I had done a lot of First Amendment work, a lot of cases. I had lectured on it. I had written law review articles on the First Amendment. I'm still reading a lot in the First Amendment area because it is so important. Free speech is very, very important. And so that was a fulfilling argument for me, let me put it that way. And that's the story. Now, there was feedback. There was a lot of positive feedback about testifying against someone like that, and but there was also negative feedback. And there was one of my partners really started checking my head to see if I had horns. I mean, it was kind of, you know, my view of politics is it's certainly right now it's true, is inferior to courtroom truth. Courtroom truth is very real. I mean, people get cross-examined. You can't just make stuff up. I mean, it's like, you know, you have to be honest about it, or you might get charged with perjury. So courtroom truth versus political truth, I came away from my Washington experiences with the idea that courtroom truth is far superior to political truth.
Oh, political truth. Yeah, well, that's that's a whole different story. Now, one of the things I do here on Joy and Papers, about 6 months after I started the program, I was hearing from authors about their legal problems that they were having. People who, you know, would have either they would be questioned about something that they wrote about, or they would be afraid of something, or they were plagiarized. One of my first guests discovered that her books were being pirated in Australia and New Zealand, and
wow.
so you know. At that point, I brought into the program a lawyer, Bill Larson, intellectual property lawyer, and a member of Ape Law, which is, you know, the intellectual property group.
Yeah.
Because really, for an author, it is so difficult. They have to wear so many hats. Not only do they write, they have to do marketing. They have to do publicity. They have to understand the law. It's very difficult. Now, what intellectual property cases come to mind that you've worked on?
Well, I did a trademark case, which was very interesting. It had to do with products, and were they sufficiently similar that it was a trademark violation? You have to protect your trademark. You have to show that it was important to you that it not be utilized by other people. There's a case in the U.S. Supreme Court this year that has to do with whether an effort was made to make a dog toy like a bottle of liquor. And the Supreme Court came down with a rule, I'm not sure it's new, about did the dog's toy appear as though it was actually made by the liquor company? And that's an interesting standard. But there are great experts in the world on all this, as you know, the intellectual property kind of things. Certainly, when you represent newspapers, there's all kinds of privacy issues, and there still is privacy, and there's many, many rules about what you can use and what you cannot use. I will say that my newspaper clients put a higher premium on getting the story out than necessarily always adhering to the fine points of that. And for a good story, you know, they really want to put it out there. And someone, the editor, has to decide whether to do that or not. There's censorship cases where I think I may have prosecuted one pornography case way back and refused to do a case. I take every kind of case, and the book reflects that. In other words, I tried just about every kind of case, but I had one man wanted me to represent his brother, and he had child pornography stuff. I just didn't want to do it. I didn't think I was the right lawyer to do that, and so I didn't. I said, no, I don't want to do it. But those are some examples of the kinds of things. I think there's a point here that you're bringing up. When I started, the trial lawyers that I admired greatly and was trying to imitate, they thought they could try any kind of case. And yes, there were specialists in personal injury and criminal and all that, but the trial lawyers thought that if I can try one kind of case, I can try any kind of case. I agree with that. Although, as the years went on and we had teams of lawyers, I would have, for example, in a patent case, and I tried, I think I had about 20 patent cases, which I tried several. And I would have a patent lawyer, a real expert, with me on the team. And that became very common starting probably about 20 years ago. The teams got much bigger. On the civil side, the amount of damages, you can read in the papers, such and such a company just settled the case for $2 billion. All of that changed during my lifetime as a trial lawyer, and became really a threatening event to a company.
Well, you never had any AI cases, right?
No. Well, no. Not that I was aware of, although, you know, I think AI has been around longer than we think. They keep talking about it's coming. I think it's here. Now that I'm working on my book, as you say, marketing my book, you know how Amazon works is if people are buying a lot of a book, They do what grocers used to do. They put it in the front window. And in other words, they make it more prominent. And all of that, I think, is, I'll call it mechanized, using the old term word. But that's all AI. I suspect strongly that AI is making a lot of decisions down at my Safeway store here in California. As to certain products are selling more, they get more shelf space. I'm sure that's true.
They're doing it. And for authors, I mean, that's one of the biggest questions now for authors, because so many authors are upset that if AI starts writing books, AI is actually ingesting or eating up or sucking up all the books that it can find, and what it spits out is actually the product of maybe dozens of authors.
Well, if we're going to have censorship and AI books, then they can both rattle each other's cages. But I hear that. I read that. The human element is very important and will not be duplicated by AI, despite I heard a speech by a brilliant owner of a huge AI company about all the things it can do. But sentiment is something it's hard to replicate, and AI is dependent on what is fed into it. And I know that the writers down in Hollywood are very worried about this. I get it. It would be less expensive for the producers of books, I suppose. So I'm not saying it's not going to happen. But recently you may have seen a lawyer check AI and put in five cases in a brief. Turned out none of them existed. And
I read that one. Well, I can tell you one thing AI could not do. They could not do the work that you've done over 50 years of
60. Don't cut me short.
Oh,
there.
My goodness.
60 years.
60 yeah. years of being there in the courtroom and with all the fascinating cases you've done, all the just wonderful, wonderful work you've done. And a lot of it, you know, the finding justice and working to get justice for your clients has been so much a part of your life. And also the mentoring of a whole new generation or several generations now of lawyers. I think that nobody could replace you with AI. So I am so proud that you've been on the program. As you can see, I gave you the whole hour. I don't normally do that, you know.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. And I hope your readers, if they do get the book, will enjoy it. It tells a story about courts, and I hope they would enjoy it.
Well, you know, I had the U.S. Poet Laureate on, and I gave him the whole hour. And that's where I put you up there at the very top, because you are so fascinating. The book is just wonderful, and I encourage everybody to read it, but particularly writers, because if you're a writer, there are, in this book, it will give you so many ideas for books that you want to write and want to do the research on, the cases that James Brosnahan has handled over the years. I mean, all of them could be turned into novels. So, Jim, I want to thank you again for being on Joy on Paper. It has been an absolute joy talking to you.
Thank you so much, and I love your program. I hope I can figure out how to listen to it.
Send you a link. I'll send you a link tomorrow so you
That'd
can listen
great.
To it, because I know that, and I, as a matter of fact, I always save one or two programs that, you know, if there's a holiday and I want to rerun a program, this program is going to be at the top, because I want more people to listen to it, and I will keep talking about this book. I love it. And Jim, thank you again so much for being on Joy on Paper.
You're very kind. Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow. James Brosnahan. This is a fantastic book. I could just use this book and write, I think, at least 25 novels from this book. Anyway, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very lucky, you might actually see them on streaming video, and you never know. And I'm hoping that for Carol J. Perry with her Witch City Mysteries, she's working on number 14. My goodness, I can't believe it. Anyway, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed, for everything. He saluted me, and I wish I was I wish I was a general. I would be out there, and I would be changing the way things are being done. But anyway, everybody, have a wonderful weekend. Stay cool. Stay somewhere in the shade and by the pool. Read a good book, and then decide that this is the year that you're going to write your own book. Anyway, everybody, bye-bye now. Take care.